After the first few years of slaughter, most Holiness enclaves had found themselves with incredibly high male-female ratios. Now, women were valuable chattel in the loose, macho, hyper-survivalist societies. No wonder some of the raiders below wanted to carry this one back. Gordon could tell that she might be quite pretty if she healed and if the pall of terror ever left her eyes. The boy in her arms watched the men with fierce anger. Gordon surmised that the Rogue River gangs must have become organized at last, perhaps under a charismatic leader. Apparently they were planning to invade by sea, skirting the Roseville and Camas Valley defenses, where the farmers had somehow beaten back their repeated efforts at conquest. It was a bold plan, and it could very well mean the end of whatever flickering civilization remained here in the Willamette Valley. Until now, Gordon had been telling himself he might somehow stay out of this trouble, but the last 17 years had long ago made almost everybody alive take sides in this particular struggle. Rival villages with bitter feuds would drop their quarrels to join and wipe out bands like these. The very sight of army surplus camouflage and gold earrings elicited a loathing response that was common nearly everywhere, like the way people felt about vultures. Gordon could not leave this place without at least trying to think of a way to harm the men below. During a lull in the rain, two men went outside and began stripping the bodies, mutilating them and taking grisly trophies. When the drizzle returned, the raiders shifted their attention to the wagons, rummaging through them for anything valuable. From their curses, it seemed the search was futile. Gordon heard the smashing of delicate and totally irreplaceable electronics parts under their boots. Only the one guarding the captives was still in view, turned away from both Gordon and the wall of mirrors. He was cleaning his weapon, not paying particular attention. Wishing he were less a fool, Gordon felt compelled to take a chance. He lifted his head above the level of the floor and raised his hand. The motion made the woman look up. Her eyes widened in surprise. Gordon put a finger to his lips, praying she would understand that these men were his enemies, too. The woman blinked, and Gordon feared for a moment she was about to speak. She glanced quickly at her guard, who remained absorbed in his weapon. When her eyes met Gordon's again, she nodded slightly. He gave her a thumbs-up sign and quickly backed away from the balcony. First chance, he drew his canteen and drank deeply, for his mouth was dry as ashes. Gordon found an office in which the dust wasn't too thick. He certainly couldn't afford to sneeze, and chewed on a strip of Cresswell beef jerky as he settled down to wait. His chance came a little while before dusk. Three of the raiders left on a patrol. The one called Little Jim remained behind to cook a raggedly butchered haunch of deer in the fireplace. A gaunt-faced Holiness with three gold earrings guarded the prisoners, staring at the young woman while whittling slowly on a piece of wood. Gordon wondered how long it would take for the guard's lust to overcome his fear of the leader's wrath. He was obviously working up his nerve. Gordon had his bow ready. An arrow was knocked, and two more lay on the carpet before him. His holster flap was free, and the pistol's hammer rested on a sixth round. There was little more he could do but wait. The guard put down his whittling and stood up. The woman held the boy close and looked away as he walked closer.
"Blue one ain't gonna like it,"
the bandit by the fire warned lowly. The guard stood over the woman. She tried not to flinch, but shivered when he touched her hair. The boy's eyes glistened with anger.
"Blue one already said we're gonna waste her later after taking turns. Don't see why my turn shouldn't come first. Maybe I can even get her to talk about that Cyclops thing."
"How about it, babe?"
He leered down on her.
"If a beating won't make you loosen your mouth, I know just what'll tame you down."
"What about the kid?"
Little Jim asked. The guard shrugged casually.
"What about him?"
Suddenly, a hunting knife was in his right hand. With his left, he seized the boy's hair and yanked him out of the woman's grasp. She screamed. In that telescoped instant, Gordon acted completely on reflex. There was no time at all to think. Even so, he did not do the obvious, but what was necessary. Instead of shooting at the man with the knife, he swung his bow up and put an arrow into Little Jim's chest. The small survivalist hopped back and stared down at the shaft in blank surprise. With a faint gurgle, he slumped to the ground. Gordon quickly knocked another arrow and turned in time to see the other survivalist yank his knife out of the girl's shoulder. She must have hurled herself in between him and the child, blocking the blow with her body. The boy lay stunned in the corner. Gravely wounded, she still tore at her enemy with her nails, unfortunately blocking Gordon from a clear shot. The surprised bandit fumbled at first, cursing and trying to catch her wrists. Finally, he managed to hurl her to the ground. Angered by the painful scratches and unaware of his partner's demise, the wholeness grinned and hefted his knife to finish the job. He took a step toward the wounded, gasping woman. At that point, Gordon's arrow tore through the fabric of his camouflage fatigues, slicing a shallow, bloody gash along his back. The shaft struck the couch and quivered, humming. For all their loathsome attributes, survivalists were probably the best fighters in all the world. In a blur, before Gordon could snatch up his last arrow, the man dove to one side and rolled up with his assault rifle. Gordon threw himself back as a rapid, accurate burst of individual shots tore into the balustrade, ricocheting from the ironmongery where he had just been. The rifle was equipped with a silencer, forcing the raider to fire on semi-automatic, but the zinging bullets clanged all about Gordon as he rolled over and pulled out his own revolver. He scurried over to another part of the balcony. The fellow down below had good ears. Another rapid burst sent slivers flying inches from Gordon's face as he ducked aside again, barely in time. Silence fell, except that Gordon's pulse sounded like thunder in his ears. "Now what?" he wondered. Suddenly there was a loud scream. Gordon raised his head and caught a blurry motion reflected in the mirror. The small woman below was charging her much bigger foe with a large chair raised over her head. The survivalist whirled and fired. Red blotches bloomed across the young gleaner's chest, and she tumbled to the ground. The chair rolled to the survivalist's feet. Gordon might have heard the click as the rifle's magazine emptied, or perhaps it was only a wild guess. Whatever the reason, without thinking, he leapt up, arms extended, and squeezed the trigger of his .38 over and over again, pumping until the hammer struck 5 times on empty smoking chambers. His opponent remained standing, a fresh clip already in his left hand, ready to be slammed into place, but dark stains had begun to spread across the camouflage tunic. Looking astonished, more than anything else, his eyes met Gordon's over the smoking pistol barrel. The assault rifle tipped and fell clattering from limp fingers, and the survivalist crumpled to the floor. Gordon ran downstairs, vaulting the rail at the bottom. First, he stopped at both men and made sure they were dead. Then he hurried over to the fatally wounded young woman. Her mouth made a round inquiry as he lifted her head.
"Who?"
"Don't talk," he urged, and he wiped a trail of blood from the corner of her mouth. Pupils, widely dilated, eerily alert on the threshold of death, her eyes took in his face, his uniform, the embroidered, restored U.S. mail service patch over his breast pocket. They widened briefly in question, in wonder.
"Let her believe," Gordon told himself. "She's dying. Let her believe it's true."
But he couldn't make himself say the words, the lies that he had told so often, that had taken him so far for so many months. Not this time.
"I'm just a traveler, miss," he shook his head.
I'm just a fellow citizen, trying to help." She nodded, only slightly disappointed, it seemed, as if that in itself were a minor miracle.
"North," she gasped. "Big boy. Warn Cyclops."
In that last word, even as her dying breath sighed away, Gordon heard reverence, loyalty, and a confident faith in ultimate redemption, all in the spoken name of a machine.
"Cyclops,"
he thought numbly as he laid her body down. Now he had yet another reason to follow the legend to its source. There was no time to spare for a burial. The bandit's rifle had been muffled, but Gordon's .38 had echoed like thunder. The other raiders would certainly have heard. He had only moments to collect the child and clear out of this place. But 10 feet away there were horses to steal, And up north lay something a brave young woman had thought worth dying for.
If only it's true,
Gordon thought, as he gathered up his enemy's rifle and ammunition. He would drop his postal play act in a minute if he found that someone, somewhere, was taking responsibility, actually trying to do something about the Dark Age. He would offer his allegiance, his help, however meager it might be, even to a giant computer. There were distant shouts coming closer rapidly. He turned to the boy, who was now looking up at him, wide-eyed, from the corner of the room. "Come on, then," Gordon said, holding out his hand. "We had better ride." 4. Harrisburg. Holding the child on a saddle in front of him, Gordon raced away from the grisly scene as fast as his stolen mount would go. A glance showed figures charging after them on foot. One raider knelt to take careful aim. Gordon bent forward, sawed on the reins, and kicked. The horse snorted and wheeled around a looted corner Rexall store just as high-velocity bullets tore apart the granite facing behind them. Stone chips flew whistling across Sixth Avenue. He had been congratulating himself on taking the added time to scatter the other horses before galloping off, but in that last instant, looking back, Gordon had seen one more raider arrive, riding his own pony. For a moment he felt an unreasoning fear. If they had his horse, they might also have taken or harmed the mail bags. Gordon shook the irrelevant thought aside as he sent the horse dashing down a side street. The hell with the letters! They were only props, anyway. What mattered was that only one of the survivalists could pursue at the moment. That made the odds even. Almost. He snapped the reins and dug in his heels, sending his mount galloping hard down one of downtown Eugene's silent, empty streets. He heard the clatter of other hooves, too close. Not bothering to look back, he swerved into an alley. The horse pranced past a fall of shattered glass, then sped across the next street, through a service way and down another clutter-filled alley. Gordon turned the animal toward a flash of greenery, cantering quickly across an open plaza, and pulled up behind an overgrown oak thicket in a small park. There was a roar in the air. After a moment, Gordon realized that it was his own breath and pulse.
Are you all right?
He panted, looking down at the boy. The 9-year-old swallowed and nodded, not wasting breath on words. The boy had been terrorized and had witnessed savage things today, but he had the sense to keep quiet, brown eyes intense on Gordon. Gordon stood in the saddle and peered through the 17-year growth of urban shrubbery. For the moment, at least, they seemed to have lost their pursuer. Of course, the fellow might be less than 50 meters away, quietly listening himself. Gordon's fingers were shaking from reaction, but he managed to draw his empty .38 from its holster and reloaded while he tried to think. If there was only the single rider to contend with, they might do better to just stay still and wait it out. Let the bandits seek them, and inevitably drift farther away. Unfortunately, the other Holnists would catch up soon. It would probably be better to risk a little noise now than let those master trackers and hunters from the Rogue River country collect themselves and organize a real search of the local area. He stroked the horse's neck, letting the animal catch its breath for a moment longer. "What's your name?" he asked the boy.
"Mark,"
he blinked. "Mine is Gordon." "Was that your sister, who saved our lives back there at the fireplace?" Mark shook his head. A child of the Dark Age, he would save his tears for later.
"No, sir. It was my mom."
Gordon grunted, surprised. These days it was uncommon for women to look so young after having children. Mark's mother must have lived under unusual conditions. One more clue pointing to mysterious happenings in northern Oregon. The light was fading fast. Still hearing nothing, Gordon nudged the horse into motion once more, guiding it with his knees, letting it choose soft ground where it could. He kept a sharp lookout and stopped often to listen. Some minutes later they heard a shout. The boy tensed, but the source must have been blocks away. Gordon headed in the other direction, thinking of the Willamette River bridges at the northern end of town. The long twilight was over before they rode up to the Route 105 bridge. The clouds had stopped dripping, but they still cast a dark gloom over ruins on all sides, denying even the starlight. Gordon stared, trying to penetrate the gloom. Rumor to the south had it the bridge was still up, and there were no obvious signs of an ambush. And yet, anything could hide in that mass of dark girders, including an experienced bushwhacker with a rifle. Gordon shook his head. He hadn't lived this long by taking foolish chances, not when there were alternatives. He had wanted to take the old interstate, the direct route to Corvallis and the mysterious domain of Cyclops. But there were other ways. He swung the horse about and headed west, away from the dark, glowering towers. There followed a hurried, twisting ride down side streets. Several times he nearly got lost and had to go by dead reckoning. At last, he found old Highway 99 by the sound of rushing water. Here the bridge was a flat, open structure, and apparently clear. Anyway, it was the last path he knew of. Bent low over the boy, he took the span at a gallop and kept on riding hard until he was certain all pursuit had been left far behind. Finally, he dismounted and led the horse for a while, letting the exhausted animal catch its breath. When he climbed back into the saddle, young Mark had fallen asleep. Gordon spread his poncho to cover them both as they plodded on northward, seeking a light. About an hour before dawn, they arrived at last at the walled village of Harrisburg. The stories Gordon had heard about prosperous northern Oregon must have been understated. The town had apparently been at peace much, much too long. Thick undergrowth covered the free fire zone all the way to the town wall, and there were no guards on the watchtowers. Gordon had to shout for 5 minutes before anyone arrived to swing back the gate. "I want to talk to your leaders," he told them under the sheltered porch of the general store. "There's worse danger than you've known in years." He described the ambushed party of gleaners, the band of hard, evil men, and their mission to scout the soft northern Willamette for plundering. Time was of the essence. They had to move quickly and destroy the Holnists before their mission was accomplished. But to his dismay, the sleepy-eyed townsmen seemed slow to believe his story, and even more reluctant to sally forth in the wet weather. They stared at Gordon suspiciously and shook their heads sullenly when he insisted they call up a posse. Young Mark had collapsed in exhaustion and wasn't much of a witness to corroborate his tale. The locals obviously preferred to believe he was exaggerating. Several men stated baldly that he must have run into a few local bandits from south of Eugene, where Cyclops still had little influence. After all, nobody had seen any wholeness around these parts in many years. They were supposed to have killed each other off long ago after Nathan Holm himself was hanged. Folk patted him on the back reassuringly and started dispersing to their homes. The storekeeper offered to let Gordon sack out in his storeroom.
"I can't believe this is happening. Don't these idiots realize their very lives are at stake? If the scouting party gets away, those barbarians will be back in force."
"Listen." He tried again, but their sullen, rural obstinacy was impervious to logic. One by one, they drifted away. Desperate, exhausted, and angry, Gordon flung back his poncho, revealing the postal inspector's uniform underneath. In a fury, he stormed at them. "You all don't seem to understand. I am not asking you for your help. Do you think I give a damn about your stupid little village? I care about one thing above all. Those creatures have 2 bags of mail that they have stolen from the people of the United States, and I am commanding you, under my authority as a federal official, to gather an armed party and assist in their recovery." Gordon had had a lot of practice with the role in recent months, but never had he dared such an arrogant pose. It had completely carried him away. When one of the wide-eyed villagers started stammering, he cut the man short, his voice shaking with outrage as he told them of the wrath that would fall when the restored nation learned of this shame, how a silly little hamlet had cowered behind its walls and so let their country's sworn enemies escape. His eyes narrowed as he growled lowly, "You ignorant Pumpkins have 10 minutes to form your militia and be ready to ride, or I warn you, the consequences will be far more unpleasant for you all than a forced march in the rain.
The townsfolk blinked in astonishment. Most of them had not even moved, but stared at his uniform and the shiny badge on his peaked hat. The true danger that faced them they could try to ignore, but this fantastic story had to be swallowed whole, or not at all. For a long moment the tableau held, and Gordon stared them down until it broke. All at once men were shouting at one another, running about to gather weapons. Women hurried to prepare the horses and gear. Gordon was left standing there, his poncho like a cape, whipping behind him in the blustery wind, cursing silently while the Harrisburg guard turned out around him.
"What in God's name came over me?"
he asked himself at last. Maybe his role was starting to get to him, for during those tense moments as he had faced down an entire town, he had truly believed. He had felt the power of his role, the potent anger of a servant of the people, thwarted in a high task by little men. The episode left him shaken and a little uncertain of his own mental equilibrium. One thing was clear. He had hoped to give up the postman's scam on reaching northern Oregon, but that was no longer possible. He was stuck with it now, for better or for worse. All was ready in a quarter of an hour. He left the boy in the care of a local family and departed with the posse in a drizzling rain. The ride was quicker this time, in daylight and with remounts. Gordon made sure they sent out scouts and flankers to guard against ambush and kept the main party in three separated squads. When they finally arrived at the UO campus, the militia dismounted to converge on the student center. Although the locals outnumbered the survivalist band by at least 8-1, Gordon figured the odds were actually about even. Wincing at every sound as the clumsy farmers approached the scene of the massacre, he nervously scanned the rooftops and windows.
"I hear that down south they stopped the Holnists with sheer guts and determination. They've got some legendary leader down there who's whipped the survivalists 3 falls out of 4. Must be the reason the bastards are trying this end run up the coast. Things are different up here. If this invasion ever really develops, these locals haven't got a chance."
When they finally burst into the student center, the raiders were long gone. The fireplace was cold. Tracks in the muddy street led westward toward the coastal passes and the sea. The victims of the massacre were found laid out in the old cafeteria, ears and other parts removed as trophies. The villagers stared at the havoc the automatic rifles had wrought, rediscovering uncomfortable memories of the early days. Gordon had to remind them to get a burial detail together. It was a frustrating morning. There was no way to prove who the bandits had been, not without following them, and Gordon wasn't about to try with this reluctant band of farmers. They already wanted to go home to their tall, safe stockade. Sighing, Gordon insisted that they make one more stop. In the dank, ruined university gymnasium, he found his mail sacks, one untouched where he had hidden it, the other torn open, letters scattered and trodden on the floor. Gordon put on an irate show of fury for the benefit of the locals, who hurried obsequiously to help him collect and bag the remains. He played the role of the outraged postal inspector to the hilt, calling down vengeance on those who dared interfere with the mail. But this time it was really only an act. Inside, all Gordon could think of was how hungry and tired of it all he was. The slow, plodding ride back in a chill fog was sheer hell. But the ordeal went on at Harrisburg. There, Gordon had to go through all the motions again, passing out a few letters he had collected in the towns south of Eugene, listening to tearful jubilation as a couple of lucky ones learned of a relative or friend thought long dead, appointing a local postmaster, and during another silly celebration. The next day he awoke stiff and sore and a little feverish. His dreams had been dire, all ending with a questioning, hopeful look in a dying woman's eyes. Nothing the villagers could say would make him remain another hour. He saddled a fresh horse, secured the mailbags, and headed north immediately after breakfast. It was time, at last, to go see Cyclops. 5. Corvallis. May 18, 2011. Transmittal via Shed, Harrisburg, Cresswell, Cottage Grove, Culp Creek, Oak Ridge, to Pineview. Dear Mrs. Thompson, your first three letters finally caught up with me in Shed, just south of Corvallis. I can't tell you how glad I was to get them. And news from Abby and Michael, too. I'm very happy for them both, and I hope it will be a girl. I note that you've expanded your local mail route to include Gilchrist, New Bend, and Redmond. Enclosed are temporary warrants for the postmasters you recommended, to be confirmed later. Your initiative is to be applauded. The news of a change in regime in Oak Ridge was welcome. I hope their revolution lasts. It was quiet in the paneled guest room as the silver fountain pen scritch-scratched across the slightly yellowed paper. Through the open window, with a pale moon shining amid scattered night clouds, Gordon could hear distant music and laughter from the hoedown he had left a little while ago, pleading fatigue. By now, Gordon was accustomed to these exuberant first-day festivities as locals pulled out the stops for the visiting government man. The biggest difference here was that he had not seen so many people in one place since the food center riots, long, long ago. The music was still of the land. With the fall, people everywhere had returned to the fiddle and the banjo, to simple fare and square dances. In many ways, it was all so very familiar. But there are other differences as well. Gordon rolled his fountain pen in his fingers and touched the letters from his friends in Pineview. Arriving with serendipitous timing, they had been real help in establishing his bona fides. The mail courier from the southern Willamette, a man Gordon himself had appointed only 2 weeks ago, had arrived on a steaming mount and refused even a glass of water until he reported to the inspector. The earnest youth's behavior emphatically dissolved all remaining doubts the locals might have had. His fairy tale still worked. For now, at least. Gordon picked up the pen again and wrote. By now you'll have received my warning of a possible invasion by Rogue River survivalists. I know you'll take appropriate measures for the defense of Pineview. Still, here in the strange domain of Cyclops, I find it hard to get anyone to take the threat seriously. By today's standards, they've been at peace here a very long time. They treat me well, but people apparently think I am exaggerating the threat. Tomorrow, at last, I have my interview. Perhaps I can persuade Cyclops itself of the danger. It would be sad if this strange little society led by a machine fell to the barbarians. It is the finest thing I have seen since leaving the civilized East. Gordon amended the remark in his own mind. The lower Willamette was the most civilized area he had encountered in 15 years, period. It was a miracle of peace and prosperity, apparently wrought entirely by an intelligent computer and its dedicated human servants. Gordon stopped writing and looked up as the lamp by his desk flickered. Under a chintz shade, the 40-watt incandescent bulb winked once more, then returned to a steady glow as the wind generators 2 buildings away regained their stride. The light was soft, but Gordon found his eyes watering each time he looked at it for even a little while. He still had not gotten over it. On arriving in Corvallis, he had seen his first working electric light in over a decade, and had been forced to excuse himself even as local dignitaries gathered to welcome him. He took refuge in a washroom to hide until he could regain his composure. It just wouldn't do for a supposed representative of the government in St. Paul City to be seen weeping openly at the sight of a few flickering bulbs. Kravala Senate's environs are divided into independent boroughs, each supporting about 200 or 300 people. All the land hereabouts is cultivated or ranched, using modern farming arts and hybrid seed the locals raise themselves. They have managed to maintain several pre-war strains of bioengineered yeast and produce medicines and fertilizers from them. Of course, they're limited to horse plows, but their smithies make implements from high-quality steel. They have even started producing hand-built water and wind-powered turbines, all designed by Cyclops, of course. Local craftsmen have expressed an interest in trading with customers to the south and east. I'll enclose a list of items they're willing to barter for. Copy it and pass it along the line, will you? Gordon had not seen so many happy, well-fed people since before the war, nor heard laughter so easy and often. There was a newspaper and a lending library, and every child in the valley got at least 4 years of schooling. Here, at last, was what he had been looking for since his militia unit broke up in confusion and despair a decade and a half ago. A community of good people engaged in a vigorous effort to rebuild. Gordon wished he could be a part of it, not a con artist ripping them off for a few nights' meals and a free bed. Ironically, these people would have accepted the old Gordon Kranz as a new citizen, but he was indelibly branded by the uniform he wore and by his actions back at Harrisburg. If he revealed the truth now, he was certain they would never forgive him. He had to be a demigod in their eyes, or nothing at all, if ever a man was trapped in his own lie. Gordon shook his head. He would have to take the hand he had been dealt. Perhaps these people really could use a mailman. So far, I haven't been able to find out much about Cyclops itself. I've been told that the supercomputer does not govern directly, but insists that all the villages and towns it serves live together peaceably and democratically. In effect, it has become judge-arbitrator for the entire lower Willamette, all the way north to the Columbia. The council tells me Cyclops is very interested in seeing a formal mail route created, and has offered every assistance. It seems anxious to cooperate with the restored U.S. Everyone, of course, was glad to hear that they would soon be in contact with the rest of the country again. Gordon looked at the last line for a long moment, his pen poised, and realized that he simply couldn't go on with the lies tonight. It was no longer amusing, knowing Mrs. Thompson would read through them. It made him feel sad.
Just as well. I have a busy day tomorrow.
He covered the pen and got up to prepare for bed. While he washed his face, he thought about the last time he had met one of the legendary supercomputers. It had been only months before the war, when he was an 18-year-old sophomore in college. All the talk had been about the new intelligent machines just then being unveiled in a few locations. It was a time of excitement. The media trumpeted the breakthrough as the end of humanity's long loneliness. Only instead of coming from outer space, the other intelligences with whom man would share his world would be his own creations. The neo-hippies and campus editors of New Renaissance magazine held a grand birthday party the day the University of Minnesota put one of the latest supercomps on display. Balloons floated by. Aerostat artists pedaled overhead, music filled the air while people picnicked on the lawns. In the midst of it all, inside a mammoth, metal-mesh Faraday cage suspended on a cushion of air, they had sealed the helium-cooled cylinder containing millichrome. Set up this way, internally powered and shielded, there was no way anyone from the outside could fake the mechanical brain's responses. He stood in line for hours that afternoon, when at last Gordon's turn came to step forward and face the narrow camera lens. He brought out a list of test questions, two riddles, and a complicated play on words. It was so very long ago that bright day in the spring of hope. Yet Gordon remembered it as if it were yesterday. The low, mellifluous voice, the friendly, open laughter of the machine. On that day, Millichrome met all his challenges and responded with an intricate pun of its own. It also chided him, gently, for not doing as well as expected on a recent history exam. When his turn was over, Gordon had walked away feeling a great, heady joy that his species had created such a wonder. The Doom War came soon thereafter. For 17 awful years, he had simply assumed that all of the beautiful super comps were dead, like the broken hopes of a nation and a world. But here, by some wonder, one lived. Somehow, by pluck and ingenuity, the Oregon State Techs had managed to keep a machine going through all the bad years. He couldn't help feeling unworthy and presumptuous to have come posing among such men and women. Gordon reverently switched off the electric light and lay in bed, listening to the night. In the distance, the music from the Corvallis hoedown finally ended with a whooping cheer. Then he could hear the crowd dispersing for home. Finally, the evening quieted down. There was wind in the trees outside his window, and the faint whine of the nearby compressors that kept the delicate brain of Cyclops super cold and healthy. And there was something else as well. Through the night came a rich, soft, sweet sound that he could barely place, though it tugged at his memory. After a while it came to him. Somebody, probably one of the technicians, was playing classical music on a stereo. A stereo. Gordon tasted the word. He had nothing against banjos and fiddles, but after 15 years, to hear Beethoven again. Sleep came at last, and the symphony blended into his dreaming. The notes rose and fell, and finally melded with a gentle, melodious voice that spoke to him across the decades. An articulated metal hand extended past the fog of years and pointed straight at him.
"Liar,"
the voice said softly, sadly.
"You disappoint me so. How can I help you, my makers, if you tell only lies?"
6. Dina.
"This former factory is where we salvage equipment for the Millennium Project. You can see we've really hardly begun. We can't start building true robots, as Cyclops' plans call for later on, until we've recovered some industrial capability first."
Gordon's guide led him down a cavern of shelves stacked high with the implements of another era.
"The first step, of course, was to try to save as much as we could from rot and decay. Only some of the salvage is kept here. What has no near-term potential is stored elsewhere, against the future day."
Peter Egg, a lanky, blond man only a little older than Gordon, must have been a student at Corvallis State University when war broke out. He was one of the youngest to wear the black-trimmed white coat of a servant of Cyclops, but even he showed gray at the temples. Egg also was the uncle and sole surviving relative of the small boy Gordon had rescued in the ruins of Eugene. The man had not made any great display of gratitude, but it was clear he felt indebted to Gordon. None of those outranking him among the servants had interfered when he insisted on being the one to show the visitor Cyclops' program to hold off the Dark Age in Oregon.
"Here, we've begun repairing some small computers and other simple machines,"
Egg told Gordon, leading him past stacks of sorted and labeled electronics.
"The hardest part is replacing circuits burned out in those first few instants of the war by those high-frequency electromagnetic pulses the enemy set off above the continent, you know, by the very first bombs."
Gordon smiled indulgently, and Egg reddened. He raised a hand in apology.
"Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just so used to having to explain everything so simply. Of course, you Eastern folks probably know a lot more about the EMP than we do.
I am not a technical man, Gordon answered, and wished he had not bluffed so well. He would have liked to have heard more. But Egg went back to the subject at hand.
As I was saying, this is where most of the salvage work is done. It's painstaking effort, but as soon as electricity can be provided on a wider scale, and once more basic needs have been addressed, we plan to put these microcomputers back in outlying villages, schools, and machine shops. It's an ambitious goal, but Cyclops is certain we can make it happen in our lifetimes.
The cavern of shelves opened up into a vast factory floor. Long banks of overhead skylights spanned the ceiling, so the fluorescents were used only sparingly. Still, there was a faint hum of electricity on all sides as white-coated techs carted equipment to and fro. Against every wall was stacked tribute from the surrounding towns and hamlets, payment for the benign guidance of Cyclops. More machinery of all kinds, plus a small tithe of food and clothing for Cyclops's human helpers, came in every day. And yet, from all Gordon had heard, this salvage was easily spared by the people of the valley. After all, what use had they for the old machines anyway? No wonder there were no complaints of a tyranny by machine. The supercomputer's price was easily met, and in exchange, the valley had its Solomon, and perhaps a Moses to lead them out of this wilderness. Remembering that gentle, wise voice from so long ago, Gordon recognized the bargain.
Cyclops has carefully planned this stage of the transition,
Egg explained.
You saw our small assembly line for water and wind turbines? Besides that, we help area blacksmiths improve their forges and local farmers to plan their crops. And by distributing old handheld video games to children in the valley, we hope to make them receptive to better things, such as computers, when the time comes.
They passed a bench where gray-haired workers bent over flashing lights and screens bright with computer code. A bit light-headed from all this, Gordon felt as if he had accidentally stumbled into a bright, wondrous workshop where shattered dreams were being carefully put back together by a band of earnest, friendly gnomes. Most of the technicians were now well into or past middle age. To Gordon, it seemed they were in a hurry to accomplish as much as possible before the educated generation passed away forever.
Of course, now that contact has been reestablished with the restored U.S.,
Peter Egg continued,
we can hope to make faster progress. For instance, I could give you a long list of chips we haven't any way to manufacture. That would make a world of difference. Only 8 ounces worth could push Cyclops' program ahead by 4 years, if St. Paul City can provide what we need.
Gordon didn't want to meet the fellow's eyes. He bent over a disassembled computer, pretending to pore over the complicated innards. I know a little about such matters, he said, swallowing.
Anyway, back east, there have been other priorities than distributing video games.
He had said it that way in order not to lie any more than he had to, but the servant of Cyclops paled as if he had been struck.
Oh, yeah, so stupid. Certainly they've had to deal with terrible radiation and plagues and famine and wholeness. I guess maybe we've been pretty lucky here in Oregon. Of course, we'll just have to manage on our own until the rest of the country can help out.
Gordon nodded. Both men were speaking literal truths, but only one knew just how sadly true the words were. In the uncomfortable silence, Gordon reached for the very first question that came to mind. So, you distribute toys with batteries as sort of missionary tools? Egg laughed.
Yes, that's how you first heard of us, isn't it? It sounds primitive, I know, but it works. Come, I'll introduce you to the head of that project. If anyone is a real throwback to the 20th century, it's Dina Spurgeon. You'll see what I mean when you meet her.